John O'Brien dictating, recording an interview with Professor Hodgson in Aldeburgh, Suffolk, 9th of July, 1981. Hoddy, you were born in Uruguay about 65 years ago, is that correct?
Just about, but I've had a birthday, John. It's now 66 years ago.
Were you born in Montevideo itself?
Just outside, John.
And your parents went out to Uruguay. I think they were with the railway there, were they?
My father was an engineer constructing railroads there, yes.
Through what, all of Uruguay or South America? Or?
Argentina and Uruguay.
I see. Now, you were raised outside of Montevideo.
Right.
And you came back to school in England. You must have come back at an early age.
I came back at the age of 5, went back at the age of 8, and didn't go to school between the age of 8 and 12.
Looking back, was this a bonus, or what do you feel about that lack of...
I think I learnt more in those 4 years than I learnt in all my school years.
Who influenced you most in that time?
I think the birds and the animals and observing nature, the plants, and just having a good chance to observe nature.
And you've always been, you've always had a great love of flowers and plants and things. You think it was this time in your life when you developed that?
I think so, John.
And you had no schooling during those 4 years at all?
Well, my mother, who had been teaching in schools, taught me, but we didn't do much work.
And then at the age of 12, you were sent off to school again in England, were you?
Yes.
I see. And that was where, in Kent, I think, was it?
In Sevenoaks in Kent, uh-huh. Yeah.
And then you finished at school and you chose to go into medicine.
Right.
Who influenced you in that decision?
That's a very difficult question, John. I don't know. I didn't know what to do, as most children don't, or boys don't, when they leave school. My father wanted me to be a chartered accountant. I didn't like the thought of that. And I thought medicine would probably suit me.
And you went to which medical school?
Edinburgh University.
I see. So you had a pretty smooth sail through medicine, did you?
Well, smooth in parts and not so smooth in others.
Mm. And was there anyone in your medical training that influenced you in any way?
No, I don't really think so. We had a class of 260-something and... I think we had a mob of students, and there were far too few teachers for this great mob.
Mm. So then you graduated a couple of years before the Second War.
Yes.
And your first work as a graduate doctor was in Edinburgh, was it? Or?
Well, yes, for a housemanship in Edinburgh. And then I went down to Norwich to work with Tommy Britton and... George Kenneth McKee.
Well, Tommy Britton was the chief in orthopedics in Norwich at the time.
He was.
Well, he was to influence you quite significantly, I think, over the next few years.
Tremendously. He had a great capacity for thought, deduction, and application.
Where did he learn it from? Was he a naturally a bright sort of character? Or?
Oh, John, he was like you, Irish.
But he certainly thought clearly, you know, with his principles of arthrodesis and the analogies to bridge building and so on. He was to be a great influence in your life, was he?
He was. He was a great influence, and he taught me how to think.
Mm. Did he read much?
Yes, he read a great deal.
Yeah. Now... So that we're really up to about the time of the Second War now. This would be about 1939 or so. What sort of a war did you have?
Well, Tommy Britton, the Irishman, decided he'd join up and said I would go with him. At that time, I was very young, impressionable, and I said, all right, good. And next thing I found, I was incarcerated in Norwich, and Tommy Britton had gone to the war. So I was retained in Norwich, which at that time was in the Coastal Belt Defense region, and we had a lot of casualties every night from the RAF. At that time, the bombers went to Berlin, but they usually didn't have any petrol to get back to their home station, and they crashed around about us, and we had a very large early morning group of very dangerously damaged pilots.
Mm. Well, this must have gone on for some years.
Yes, they didn't release me until 1943, and then I joined up in the RAMC.
And did you... You left Britain, didn't you? You left England, I mean Tommy Britton.
Yes, I left England. I stayed a little time in England, but obviously the European theatre was coming to an end, so I went out to India, and then Assam and Burma and Malaysia, Singapore.
Did you get a feeling then that... Did you feel then that you might return someday to the Far East, or was it quite sort of coincidental that you did in fact go back there in 1951 to Hong Kong?
Well, whenever I travel, I have a good look around, and I stow that in my memory.
I see. So you returned after the war, and you were demobbed, and you went back to Tommy Britton in Norwich, huh?
Well, no. Tommy at that time had... filled all places in Norwich, so I went down to the Medway Towns to work with Gerald Townsley, who was at that time the chief surgeon in the Medway Towns Hospital Group at St. Bart's, Rochester.
Uh-huh. And I think you've mentioned to me before that there, at some time at about this stage in your life, you had a connection with Seddon, or some interest in peripheral nerve work, which he was doing in Oxford. Was that...
Oh, that was a long time before, John. That was when I was with Tommy Britton at the early part of the war. Tommy Britton, as you remember, was working on iscofemoral arthrodesis.
Mm.
I remember well he asking Nobby Clark and Jim Seddon to come up one weekend. And... we had all the iscofemorals in the outpatient department, and neither Nobby nor Jim Seddon could agree which patients were fused and which patients were not fused.
Mm.
At that time, I realized that the feel of an iscofemoral fusion and an iliofemoral fusion were very, very different.
The feel, the actual feel.
No, when you take the leg up in your arm, and you move it about.
Yes.
It has a very different feel. And that's one thing I learned from those two remarkable people.
Mm.
But then Seddon invited me over to Oswestry. I mean, I beg your pardon, John. We'll have to cancel that. To the Nuffield Centre in Oxford, where Seddon was working on peripheral nerves. And he wanted me to work with him. But I thought at that time, in my early stage of training, I would be rather stupid to do this. And told him so. And fortunately, he took on Bremer Hyatt, who did the job, and I'm sure did it very well, and was sunk when he was going out to India on a troop ship. A very sad loss to orthopedic surgery.
You're referring to the MRC work on the peripheral nerve...
Well, it didn't become MRC work at that time.
Uh-huh.
It became MRC work later.
I see, yes.
It was Seddon's work at that time.
I see. And if I can just ask you another question on that, the what began as a peripheral nerve injury thing actually flowed into a polio project, and was that the origin of the MRC work?
Right, and Gutmann... was there working on skin sweating using dyes to delineate where the skin sweated and where it didn't sweat.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, as you know, mm-hmm. he went to Aylesbury.
Uh-huh.
To Stoke Mandeville.
Uh-huh. Now, it was sometime before the war that you met Monica, was it?
That's a good point. I should think just about the outbreak of war.
You don't blame the war on this meeting or anything like that, do you?
I think the war was very unfortunate.
Tell me, you met her in, I think Ken McKee introduced you, is that right?
No, I met her at a party at Ken McKee's house.
Mm.
Cyril, Ken McKee's wife, was always giving parties, very good parties, mainly for airmen and servicemen round Norwich. And I, as a layman, would occasionally be invited.
I see. Now, the late 40s must have been a bit of a hard time for everyone. I mean, the National Health Service started in 1948. Consultant jobs were getting more and more difficult to obtain. And I think you've told me that you were getting a little bit fed up and you read an advertisement for a job in Hong Kong. Is that right?
That's right. First of all, after the war, rationing was still present. We had three children at that time. And things were tough living in England. In fact, I spent more time in the evening going round farmers and friends getting eggs and food for the family than I did reading orthopedic surgery. So I was also cleaning the stoves out and doing a good deal of housework. And I thought I might think about emigrating, as so many people did at that time. The thought about emigrating wasn't too difficult, but the difficult thing was where to go.
Mm.
Many people went to the States and have done very well. Many people went to Canada. Many people went to Australia. Many people went in various other parts of the world. Africa. But fortunately, I saw a little advert for a job with the University of Hong Kong. And I thought I might try this. I wouldn't have to stay there any longer than I wanted. It would be interesting.
You hadn't been to Hong Kong before?
Yes, I had, because I ended up in Singapore as consultant orthopedic surgeon to Alfie, and I went up there on a tour of inspection after Hong Kong had been relieved from the Japanese occupation.
Mm. And when you applied for the job, did you actually go out and look at the job, or did you figure that that was probably the best thing anyway, just to go out?
No, because in those days, to go out and look at the job would have taken about 4 weeks by sea.
Yes.
And you just had to take it by ear. But I did interview, or the vice chancellor interviewed me in London, and we had a long 3-hour discussion about the whole problem of Hong Kong and what the future might be and what future of orthopedic surgery would be, and the fact there was no orthopedic surgeon there. All these things made me think it was worth a chance.
He was obviously sympathetic, and he had some insight into the problems that you faced. And was he a medic himself?
Oh, yes. Lindsay Ride
yes.
was our vice chancellor at that time, and you, I think, knew
yes,
him, John.
Yes, indeed.
And he was an Australian, and he had worked there since 1928, and he knew a great deal about Hong Kong, which he was willing to impart.
Oh, well, you couldn't have been advised by a better man, because he had a remarkable time in the war, I think, in the middle of China, didn't he?
That's right. He headed the British aid group up in Kowloon and did a tremendous amount at that time.
Mm. Now, you set sail in 1951 with Monica and your first three children.
That's right.
And how long was the trip out?
It was about 3 weeks and perhaps 2 days.
Yes. And Did you arrive in the typhoon season, or?
No, we arranged it that we arrived just after the typhoon season stopped, and just as our best season in the autumn started.
So it was, what, about October sometime?
No, it was the 24th of September, 1951.
Yes. Well, it must have been a culture shock for you to appear in Hong Kong, particularly 30 years ago. It must have been a fairly raw sort of colony, being, what, 6 years post-war and still recovering, was it, or was it?
Yes, it was. It was a little rough. But we had, of course, Chinese people who are willing to work and who are really a very sophisticated and educated people.
Hmm. Now, you set about in the Department of Surgery as an orthopedic surgeon. You set about with the problems that you were faced with, obviously tuberculosis and polio and trauma, and it must have been a pretty tough grind.
Well, yes. First of all, I worked in the Department of Surgery with Professor Frank Stock, who was a great help, a great administrator, a great help in every way. And it allowed me to do my clinical practice all day long instead of doing any administration. And the problems then were not trauma so much, because we had few cars.
Mm.
My own car, when I went there, was numbered 7023. And that was the number of cars in the colony, including buses, including lorries, including everything.
Mm.
So trauma was not a problem, and if it was a problem, it was pedestrian trauma.
Mm.
So we had big problems with bone and joint tuberculosis, 500 cases an annum, and the polios. And the polios, of course, had been there for years and years and years, and new polios. We didn't even count the polios.
Mm. Which was the biggest health problem, TB or polio, as you saw it 30 years ago in Hong Kong?
I think TB was, and for this point, TB could paralyze and kill. Well, polio did this, but he did it quickly if it was going to kill.
Mm.
If it paralyzed, well, all right.
Mm-hmm.
You had plenty of time. But to see paraplegics, POTS paraplegics, after years and years and years, becoming worse and worse and worse, and then there was nowhere to put them. You couldn't treat them. There was nothing you could do.
Mm. Well, I'm going to lead into a few questions and then on to 1955, which was the year you first did the anterior approach and anterior fusion for spinal tuberculosis. But there were just there's a couple of relevant things really leading up to this particular time. One is, in historical terms, is really your association with the late Mike Wilkinson.
Yes, well, I remember in 1948 at the Royal College of, the Royal Society of Medicine, hearing Mike Wilkinson describe his excursions into the spine through a costotrans vasectomy. I remember the hair in the back of my neck rising, as did all the other people there. But it taught me something. I said, well, this might be something. And then I thought about it, but we didn't have many TB spines in those days. But I thought about it.
You must have been impressed with his concept of really that the disease was around the spine, and in the spine, and really had to be taken out in or, you know, through something more like a frontal approach than the classical posterior things which had been done in the past.
Well, I think what impressed me was here was a man who was a medical superintendent of a tuberculosis hospital who had not been taught to operate and yet had taught himself to operate because he felt the conservative treatment of spinal tuberculosis was not good enough.
Hmm.
And when I got to know him better later, We had lots of amusing conversation. Once I told him in 1956 that I'd found that paravertebral abscess invading the lung. Oh, he said, now I know why some of my patients spit up bloody sputum after the operation.
Yes. Now, you must have had a tough ride with the acute tubercular spine in the early 50s leading up to your decision to do anterior surgery for the problem. Would you just say a few words about those difficult years?
Yes, well, we went out there with preconceived ideas, which we brought from England and Europe and the States, posterior fusion and costotransversectomy. Posterior fusion we found was useless. Our recurrence rate within a very short time was very heavy. And the costotransversectomy was very difficult because we had an average involvement of vertebral bodies of 5.2. So you couldn't get at the disease through costotransversectomy. In 1954, we reviewed all our cases, at least I didn't review them. Teresa Braga, a very capable girl, reviewed all the cases we'd done and found that the recurrence rate was intolerably high. We either had to stop operating and not treat the patients or find some other way of treating them.
Was this recurrence of the disease process or pseudarthrosis? What are you talking about?
Recurrence of the disease process, John.
So you were getting abscesses?
We're getting abscesses above and below the operation area.
In spite of the drugs?
In spite of the drugs.
I see. So when did you actually get the idea that maybe just a whole new thinking and a whole new approach really had to be made to this difficult problem?
Well, John, that's a difficult question to answer, but I remember a few things. There must have been many, many more. But first of all, I remember my first post-mortem in Edinburgh and seeing at completion how beautifully the whole spine was visible, from top to bottom. Then it's obvious that the disease and reading and talking to Mike Wilkinson and discussing that the disease is not posterior, it's not lateral, it's anterior. And then we had a meeting every week with the surgical department, and we discussed our problems and had a census and had a little think over lunch. And I said stupidly at that time, I thought the way to attack spinal tuberculosis was from the front. And I said, I'd do it, but I don't know how to get there. And Frank Stark, the professor of surgery, said, well, I think I can take you there. Let's go and see. And so it started. We thought we'd start with about six cases and see how they went. Perhaps take them through a year or two and see what complications they had or so on. We hadn't a lot of time, operating time at that time. We had poor operating theaters and we weren't really very hopeful. But two things happened. First of all, we found that the relatives of nurses and doctors who had a TB spine would be brought up to see us. Now, there was a considerable number. And they implored us to operate on them. For they had already seen that a patient who was terribly ill with a TB spine would improve in the first 4 or 5 weeks after eradication of the disease enormously and start putting on weight and behaving fairly normally. So these two things really made us start to go ahead a little faster than we would have otherwise done.
And in those early days, once you did, I think you did a handful of cases and did watch them for a few months. When you did start, you must have been handling several cases a week, were you?
Yes, we're doing an average of perhaps at least four and perhaps six or seven cases a week.
And this was all acute, active tuberculosis?
It was all active tuberculosis spine. I don't know how acute it was, John. It's very difficult to say. Some of it was quite chronic.
Now, you had experience with the costo transvasectomy approach prior to that?
Very, yes. From 51 to 55, we did costo transvasectomy. I'd done them previously before I went to Hong Kong, but the results we didn't find were complete enough.
Yeah. There's recently, as you know, there's been a long study in which you've been involved with the Medical Research Council, and some definitive reports have come out comparing drug treatment with surgery and so on. Have you any views on this study that's been going on?
Yeah, I think I have, John. You see, I think the study was a little late. I think when that study appeared, the post-war nutrition problem had evaporated. I think the cases that we saw in Hong Kong in the early 50s of five vertebrae involved were no longer there. I think when you've got a small lesion with maybe a disc space and two vertebrae across the disc space involved, that's a different problem.
And you think that can be handled with drugs?
Oh, sure. The Medical Research Council trial has shown that.
Yeah, but I think you, I seem to remember you saying that with the limited disease in the early years of this anterior work, you were actually treating with drugs because you didn't have the operating time to handle them with surgery.
Oh, this is true, John. Between 1951 and probably about 1958 or 9, we were treating more cases with drugs than we were with surgery.
Yeah.
Many more.
Yeah.
And we'd take them out of the drug treatment and put them into the surgical treatment.
Now, you've seen a whole renaissance, really, in spinal surgery developing out of this fundamental work, which you started in October 1955. As you're well aware, I mean, the anterior approach to spinal disease has been revolutionary in the last 10 years or so. You must have noticed an alteration in attitude towards anterior approaches.
I think so, John. I think this is true, and I myself haven't really been too keen to encourage this, because I think what we want doing anterior spinal surgery are people like yourself who've been trained, who've thought about it and done it well. What I have a little fear is that some people rush in where perhaps some angels fear to tread. And this can, of course, be catastrophic. And I do know of cases where this has happened.
Now, in the early years there, I think you came across some characters, and certainly Dr. Harry Fang, I think, was involved with you from an early stage, was he?
Hey, very much so. When I went to Hong Kong, Frank Stock had two registrars, and one was Harry Fang. And I think the Almighty was looking at me as poor chap arrived in Hong Kong with this terrible thing to do. So Frank Stock gave me Harry Fang. And Harry has been a tremendous power in orthopedic surgery in Hong Kong.
Well, in the world, really.
And in the world. And he, of course, is president of the International Society for Rehabilitation at the present time. And As Noel Card would have said, I couldn't have liked it more.
When did you actually met Harry when you first went out there?
Right.
Oh, I see. So it's been an association of 30 years now.
That's right, exactly 30 years.
Now, the other person you met when you first went out there was the author, I think, of the Love is a Many Splendid Thing, which was actually the film made in Hong Kong. Was that Han Su-yin?
Yes, her name was Dr. Elizabeth Tang. And she was a complicated sort of a girl. She was a beautiful writer, and she wrote a great deal, particularly Chinese poems. And she was in charge of the casualty department. At least she was a casualty officer, shall I say, and in charge, and I was supposed to be supervisory charge over. So every morning after work on the way to lunch, I would pop in and see how she was doing. She was always writing poems. And I said, well, what have you done today? Well, she said, I've been telling the Chinese to come earlier to have their treatment. And I said, yes, good. And the Chinese came at a very late stage in those days. They'd had Chinese herbs, Chinese mints and everything. She didn't bother to treat them. She just said, come earlier next time. After many years in Hong Kong and with Chinese, I think perhaps she was right.
Now, your involvement with the, your collaboration with the nuns, with the missionary sisters of St. Columban goes back a long time, too.
Yes, it goes back to 51 when I got there. The first thing, having been landed this rather large plateful of stuff in the way of orthopedic problems, they phoned me up and asked me to go down and see a tuberculosis of the spine. And I went down. They had just finished their operating theater, and they had tremendous facilities because these girls were really dedicated. They didn't go out with boys, and they didn't go to pictures, and they didn't go out for dinner much.
Would you like to mention just a couple of them?
Yes, I'd like to mention Sister Gable, with whom I was very closely associated, and Sister Mary Aquinas. And of course, Mary Aquinas is a charming Irish girl. And I remember we were opening something or other at one time, and it was a Friday, and she was eating a meat sandwich. And I said to her, what are you doing then? She says, don't remind me, don't remind me, don't remind me.
Yes, they were pioneers, really, in total sort of patient care, as I saw in Hong Kong.
They were pioneers in perfection in medical care of patients. Mm. The notes were excellent.
Yeah.
And if they phoned you up in the middle of the night, you didn't ask what it was, you just went there.
Yeah. Have you seen that quality of medical and nursing care repeated anywhere?
No, John.
No, I haven't. It was... I've seen them actually monitor patients every couple of minutes after spinal surgery. And I mean pulse, blood pressure, everything. And the appropriate amount of the appropriate drug would then be given to sort everything out. But they were a great help to you, obviously.
Oh, John, unless if I hadn't had that capacity of nursing care and post-operative care...
Mm.
I wouldn't have dared go ahead with the surgery.
And this was all being done at Ruttenji.
Well, it was being done at Queen Mary as well, but it was the main TB at that time were in children, and all those were done at Ruttenji.
Yeah. Now, when did you get ideas about the development of some children's orthopedic facility at Sandy Bay?
Well, John, if you go back in British orthopedic history, there are two great men that stand out, Hugh Thomas and Sir Robert Jones. If you look at English and Scottish orthopedic history, Sir Robert Jones, after the First World War, was instrumental in... He'd already started your hospital, Oswald Street. And he was instrumental in it, supporting and encouraging people like Girdleston to start the Nufford Centre in Oxford, and many other centres, Harry Platt in Manchester and so on, and Malkin in Nottingham, and, well, the Nuffield started with two huts, and the same problem must have existed at that time. There was malnutrition, there was overcrowding, there was poor ventilation, cross-infections in the people who worked in houses. So they could operate in a few of them in hospitals, but had to put them somewhere to recover. And I think that's where the orthopedic, country orthopedic hospital started. And I had the same problem in Hong Kong. I could operate, but nowhere to put them. They couldn't go home. At home, some of the people were living 50 or 60 to a room.
50 or 60?
50 or 60 to a room.
These were refugees from mainland China?
These were, yeah, refugees, and there were no habitation at all. Nothing had been built for 10 years.
But actually, taking you up on that, that's fascinating. Of course, in 49, there had been the revolution in China, with Mao Zedong taking power in Peking. So there must have been terrific overpopulation in Hong Kong with the mass exit that there must have been.
Yeah, but then didn't reach us till about 51.
Oh, I see.
You see, Mao Zedong took only the north part.
Yeah.
And then they all came down without limbs, without whatever. The forces of Chiang Kai-shek. So they didn't reach us really till about 50 or 51.
And did you see awful, did you see horrific trauma at that time?
We saw the results of horrific trauma in the previous time. Armless, legless, people untreated.
Was there signs of cruelty, or was it just war injury that you were seeing?
I think it was mainly war injury.
Yeah.
And most of them were out in the periphery of Hong Kong.
Out in the new territory?
Yes.
Yes. So, this whole area of orthopedics in Southeast Asia, really orthopedics in the Third World, has fascinated me, because I've seen them in my time, they've come and they've gone. You've only got to take someone of the might of your colleague Donald Gunn in Singapore. He packed in there, and I think 1967, and I think you were probably the last surviving head of department that really set something up in the Third World, and you've been the longest surviving member of this elite group of professors. Is that right?
I think you could include John Golding and Jamaica.
Oh, yes.
And
that, oh, there's
think.
Many of them. And, of course,
but
Cordy Willis.
He's still there, but Cordy Willis is gone. You see, you were saying the ones who still remain, weren't
of
you?
Of the ones who remain, John Golding, I'm sorry, is still there. Yes.
Yeah, I just wouldn't like to forget John Golding.
No. Why do you think they... the others had to pack it in? I suppose it was just a political situation. I mean, Africa, obviously, in the 60s must have been impossible.
Well, so I was told by Ron Huxley.
Yeah. Now, do you see any future for Third World orthopedics, as far as a difference in the training that the Third World surgeon should perhaps might be getting?
Well, I think very much so, John. I think not only in every form and facet of training. You see, I think Third World people have to know about polio and tuberculosis, the bone and joint, and other curious diseases like leprosy in some parts, and many others, I'm sure, but not in those numbers.
Do you think there's any advantage in taking someone from Hong Kong or India and training him, say, in Oswestry?
Yes, I do. I do, for what Oswestry has to offer.
Yeah. But we can't train him very adequately in the management of TB and polio.
No, but you can train him in the basic skills,
yeah,
and in the training of trauma and other problems.
Yeah. Do you see that arthritis of the hip has been a factor holding back thinking in orthopedics? I'm reminded because Harry Platt told me last week that your old boss, Tommy Britton, referred to chronic remunerative arthritis as being the great drawback of orthopedic development.
I think you've got a point, John. I won't mention names, but there is a gentleman in Los Angeles who some years ago, I haven't been there for a year or two, but some years ago was charging $2,000 a hip and doing 8 hips a day and nothing else.
Well, the point is made. Now, I suppose if you had it all to do again, you would have done it exactly the same, the way you've done it.
I don't think you could, John. I think there's certain things that are fortuitous. And I think luck, I think you've got to have a little bit of thought about things. But Hong Kong could have been a catastrophe.
In what way?
Well, it might have gone to China.
It might
have done anything. It might have... anything could happen. Britain wasn't interested in it in those days. It's not very interested in it now.
Have you always felt a sense of insecurity about your time in Hong Kong?
No, John, but then I don't feel a great sense of insecurity at any time.
Well, you're a fairly secure person. But do you think, looking back, that Hong Kong has always been a little bit insecure as far as its long-term prognosis?
Well, the historians tell me that Hong Kong's been insecure since 1841 when it was founded.
Well, that's 140 years of insecurity. But I started on referring to Sandy Bay, and I was I wavered a little. You saw the need for a facility for long-term care for the crippled child in Hong Kong.
Right.
And this was the early 50s.
That's right.
Now, how did you go about that? You must have had some strong and wealthy friends to raise the money.
No, I didn't, John. I didn't. The whole thing started with a talk to Rotary. And Rotary, at the end of the talk, offered me about £3,000, which is more in those days than now. But that was useless. And I kept pegging away. I don't think I've ate so many lunches or dinners between 1952 and 1955. We tried everything. In those days, Hong Kong was poor. There was not a lot of money. And eventually, Mr. Noel Crouch had approached me and said that he would pay for 50 beds as a pilot scheme. And I'd envisaged a 50-bed unit scheme for Sandy Bay. Start with 50 and work it up from there. So we built this for about £20,000. You could build very cheaply in Hong Kong in those days. And Noel, who passed away last year, got a Chinese friend of his to build this for free. And he built it in the cheapest way possible, as the Chinese will do. And I realized this about 10 years later when the floor of one ward fell right down about 15 feet. We had to pay about the same amount of money that the whole two wards had cost us to raise the floor and refloor it.
So you finally got the fundraising going. The land was there. It had been reclaimed, I think, a lot of it.
That's right.
And, in fact, it was next to a cemetery.
It was next to a old Chinese funeral home,
mm-hmm.
where the Chinese who die overseas and want to go back to their villages to be buried are sent. They're sent, first of all, in caskets, and they have to pay so much a month for rent. And then as they can't afford to pay any more, they're put into little rattan baskets, the bones are, and it's much cheaper that way. And of course, returning to China depends on the moon, the stars, and the sun. Of course, as long as there's any money in there, they won't return to China very quickly.
I see. Now, Sandy Bay has gone ahead in leaps and bounds, I think, with about four different stages of building and development. It has been, or it probably still is, the world's largest children's orthopedic hospital with 200 beds. How do you envisage its future? Because the disease pattern is changing radically, as you well know, with TB and polio on the...
Well, we're already facing this problem, John. It's another fascinating problem. You see, tubercle is dropping. Polio has almost gone, apart from patients coming from China. We're really almost out of business. We have much more trauma than we did, and of course that is characteristic. But we're already encouraging other people, that's the pediatric surgeon, the pediatrician, to come in, because Hong Kong has no children's hospital. Excuse me. And I think probably it'll end up being a children's hospital.
Yeah. Now, I just wanted to raise the question of the future of spinal surgery, if you like, or perhaps the future of spinal disorders. You've always been a great believer in the concept of a center for spinal studies. Would you care to say a few words on that? Because I think it's an important concept.
Yes, I do, John. I have thought about this. I've been very interested in spinal surgery for reasons that we won't go into. But I've become aware that we need centrally a center for spinal surgery with, on the periphery, able to call on experts in various fields. And, of course, with this knowledge that we have now with the space age technology and all these things going so fast that neither you or I can keep up with, we have to have advice. We have to put the problem to these people and say, now, this is the problem. What is the answer?
Do you see there must be a whole lot of space-age technology, the laser beam, one example, that, I mean, has hardly been touched in spinal work.
Oh, I think in the whole of medicine, it's only just starting to come in, John, and in orthopedic surgery, certainly not much of it is in.
Do you think the medical profession are a little bit too conservative?
I think the medical profession are conservative, largely because they get up early in the morning, they work hard all day, and they go to bed at night. And they have no time to discuss with the physicist or anybody about the problems they meet during the day.
You must have seen a great change in the 30 years since you first went to Hong Kong. I mean, there's been a whole renaissance, if you like. I refer to it as that. I mean, you've got people like Dwyer and his fantastic contribution.
Yes, I think this is quite exciting, John. I remember being down in Sydney in 65 when Alan Dwyer showed his instrumentation for the first time. And what a success it has been.
For the record, was that a private meeting you had with him in 65?
No, this was at the Australian Orthopaedic Association meeting.
Did he talk about it, or was it a...
He showed one case, the first case he'd done, talked about it, and asked me to comment without discussing it with me before, which of course is typical Alan Dwyer. And of course, I just couldn't discuss it because I didn't know anything about it.
Mm.
So I had to say politely so. But I could see, after thinking about it for a day or so, that this was a great contribution. It had brought in many facets. First, an attack on the vertebral bodies, which is a big part of the spine. Second, it was the use of a coaption cable, which had never been used in orthopedic surgery before, to my knowledge. And we became great friends. And the only time, he's a great optimist, Alan. I don't know how many children he had, but I think about 10 was
it? Nine, I think it was.
Nine. And he's also a great smoker, which I tried to dissuade him his son without any success at all.
Hoddy, just to wind things up, what do you feel are the biggest problems in spinal pathology facing the physician in 1980? Now that you've sorted out many of them with your pioneering work.
You mean pathology or treatment, John?
Well, disease, just syndromes, really.
Syndrome. Well, I think that those of us who work with scoliosis now are fairly confident in it. With kyphosis, we're reasonably confident in it. With John's work on halo pelvic distraction, I think the real two problems, which are the main problems percentage-wise in the world, are cervical spondylosis and lumbar problems, low back problems.
Mm.
I think, as I see it, well, these are the patients that I see now.
Mm.
And I think I'm fairly happy in treating a cervical problem. And I think I'm fairly happy in treating a lumbar problem if the patient will do what I say.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, lots of them won't.
Mm-hmm. You've developed, of course, almost concurrently with the anti-research for tuberculosis, you've been one of the very early workers in anti-infusion for low back pain. Do you find this is the best overall sort of management for the failed case?
Yes, John, in my hands, and probably in your hands, but John, the post-operative treatment over the first 6 months, a year, is just as important as the operation.
Mm.
And a lot of people don't realize this.
Mm.
And particularly in the United States, where they only pay for the operation, they don't pay for the aftercare.
Mm.
So they're operated on discharge and left.
Mm. Are you optimistic about the future of care in spinal disorder? Do you think we're taking the right steps?
I think you are, John. I think what you want, as we just discussed, is you need a spinal center. This is not for Tom, Dick, and Harry, Mr. Orthopedic Surgeon. This is for a man who's dedicated, who's trained, and who will spend time with his patients.
Mm. I couldn't agree more. Well, Hoddy, thank you very much for your time this afternoon, and a safe trip back to Hong Kong.
Thank you, John.